You're listening to The Impromptu on the Hologram Radio Network, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. This is Alex Knight, and I am joined by Michael Norton. Episode 96, A Superhero for Everyone. Today on the podcast, Michael and I talked about Spider-Man Homecoming. We've both seen it, and just a word of warning, if you haven't seen the movie yet, and actually, frankly, if you haven't seen Wonder Woman yet, you should probably pause this episode, go watch the movie, and then come back. That's the beauty about podcasts. You can listen to this whenever you like. So we talked about those two movies and how amazing these movies are, especially the fact that Wonder Woman is the first DC movie that completely knocked it out of the park. I mean, just an all-around solid superhero movie. And it's just great that we have for the first time a strong female lead like Wonder Woman that is just such a great character that young girls can look up to, that, I mean, really anyone can look up to. And we talk about that. So stay tuned for that and more. That's coming up next on The Impromptu.
So this week, so many Apple rumors to talk about. No, just kidding.
No Apple rumors this week.
Well, there are, but forget it. We don't want to just totally do it to death before September. I mean, we still have roughly 2 months to go, I want to say. Like, probably this time in September, the announcement will have happened.
And I feel like we've said pretty much everything we really need to say. I'm sure there'll be other little things that'll come out.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll update if, like, for example, half of the phone happens to just drop on somebody's lap. I mean, something big like that, yeah. Can't really ignore it, but yeah, I mean, the press is just churning at this point. It's all, as John Gruber put it, echoes of decisions that have already been made. All these reports of Apple panicking, Apple rushing to complete things.
Well, it's just not utter nonsense that they would do that. They're not going to do that 2 months before a phone. And
no, of course,
like we've
not
talked about before, like, you can't just manufacture, I don't know how many, you know, tens of millions of phones they need in a month or two. You need to be doing that months in advance.
Well, the ramp up for production starts around now. So actually, like, the next month or so is when we should start to see parts leak, because once you ramp to the scale of millions and millions of units, it's really hard to keep things from getting out. They try. God knows they try, but it's still very difficult. They do get better at it every year, though. And at some point, they're probably just going to automate the Foxconn factory so that iPhones just come out and are immediately sealed into privacy boxes so that nobody will ever know what the iPhone looks like until September.
But today, we're not doing iPhone, are we?
No, we're not. No, because we saw Spider-Man.
It's been a big week for Spider-Man fans. Finally, Spider-Man Homecoming is out, and we have both seen it.
Yes.
And the verdict is,
it is awesome. Like, it just gets so many things right. It's the first Spider-Man film that makes them feel like kids. Like, Peter Parker is not supposed to be some 30-something pretending to be in high school. Peter Parker is supposed to be in high school, at least in the Ultimate Universe interpretation, which it's kind of the Marvel comic universe that they're mainly drawing inspiration from for the cinematic universe. So, I mean, in the Ultimate continuity, Peter Parker is in high school, and he has the mechanical web shooters and all of that stuff, and that's all transitioned directly to this film and to the cinematic continuity. Peter Parker's in high school. He's played by Tom Holland, who is 21 and thus credibly teenaged because he's not that far removed from being a teenager. 2 years.
Well, and even though he's 21, I think he looks a little bit maybe younger than he is because he's kind of a small guy.
Yeah.
And he's just very, just a bit of a baby face.
Yeah.
Right. You know, because I know how I looked like at 21 and I looked old. People said I looked older than I was. I mean, I was shaving at an early age. That's just not him. But anyways, he is right for the role. He is the youngest I think we've ever had for that character. And before we even get into the nitty-gritty details about the characterization and his portrayal, I was thinking maybe we could start with just the overall tone of the movie and maybe contrast that with some of the previous, I'm going to say, attempts, because I don't think any of them really, maybe with the exception of Spider-Man 2, got this close to, I think, what fans of the character really want.
It's the previous films have always been kind of troublesome because they tend to get a certain aspect of the character right, but then flub on other aspects. This is the first film where I would say they got all of it right, because obviously it's Marvel and it's their character and they know what they're doing. Like the Sam Raimi Spider-Mans, I would say they got Peter Parker right more than Spider-Man, but the characterization of Peter Parker veered more towards awkward dweeb than socially inept nerd, if that makes sense. Like, Tobey Maguire's portrayal hewed very close to the whole, I don't know how to talk to girls.
But I mean, but is that really fair to say? Because like any superhero character that's been around since the 20s or 30s, there, to me, it doesn't seem fair to say there is this one true characterization that's really perfect for everyone, because they've all been written by different people. Like, you can say, obviously you have to keep the underlying framework that of what that character is about. You can't just go and radically make, like, you know, giving guns to Batman doesn't make sense. Like, I'm talking about that drastic.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Peter Parker has been told slightly, like, his portrayal, the character's portrayal in different comics is different.
The problem is, in the non-Ultimate continuity, he started as a kid and he grew up. Like, he's now, like, in his 20s or 30s or, yeah, I think he's in his 30s. The Ultimate Universe Spider-Man goes back to being in high school. But the main continuity, he's like 30 now. And the storylines have matured and he's grown as a person. And he's really struggled with what it means to be a superhero and all of these things. So, I mean, to tell the origin story and then have the character closer to that interpretation doesn't quite feel right. So I think that's kind of what the other movies got wrong, where they made Spider-Man a more serious character. That's another thing too. Like, the whole deal with Spider-Man is he wisecracks, like, all the time. Constantly, like, joking at villains and messing around and jumping around them and evading their attacks.
And that's something that I really don't feel that Tobey Maguire really, and I don't want to fault him as an actor because he didn't write the dialogue.
No.
But they didn't, you know, really incorporate that fully.
No.
I mean, it's been a long time since I've seen those movies, and I'm not saying that they were completely bereft of, you know, comedy of any kind, but that's something that I think the Andrew Garfield era of Spider-Man, I think, tried to sort of make amends with a little bit in the right direction, at least.
Yeah, so the way I want to say it is, I think Sam Raimi's version of Spider-Man was kind of like the Christopher Nolan version of Spider-Man, where it was a little more realistic, a little more edgy. Of course, then in 3, it completely devolved into silliness, but so did Dark Knight Rises.
Well, hold on. Spider-Man 3, but that was the we're talking Sam Raimi still, right?
We're talking emo dancing Peter Parker.
Right. I almost walked out of the theater, by the way, when that happened. When he gets onto the stage or onto the piano and starts dancing, I had to like check myself. Like, what movie did I actually walk into? Is this Spider-Man?
No, it's Dancing with the Stars, the movie starring Tobey Maguire. No. I mean, I think they tried to go a bit more realistic, but then they ended up losing some of the core aspects of the character. And then with the Andrew Garfield version, they definitely got Spider-Man right, though I would say they still didn't quite nail the tone. He made jokes, but they were kind of badly timed and awkward. And I mean, that's down to the writing. That's not Andrew Garfield's fault, but like,
and this version
didn't quite ring true.
No, I agree. I agree. And he was already a university student at this point.
Yes.
In these movies.
So it was kind of like the ultimate continuity, but fast forward a while, I'm not sure it worked. I think it was just, I don't know. There was something kind of off about it because it felt too close to the Sam Raimi ones because they were also in university in that version. And
well, that movie rubbed me the wrong way. Just and again, these are details that only comic book nerds care about. But the origin story, the way he got bit by the spider, was they just made up their own thing. Like, he goes into that machine room thing with all the spiders and they all, like, he gets bitten by more than one, doesn't he? Or something like weird like that?
No, I think it was just the one.
Okay. Anyways, but it's not quite, I mean, they had liberties with the material.
Yeah. Like, they invented the whole subplot with his father creating the spiders and all the other stuff, and that part of it was like keyed to Peter's DNA. I mean, some of that was in the comics, but not quite in that way. Like, they kind of added a lot. Like, originally in the comic series, Peter Parker's parents turned out to be spies. And I can't remember who they were working for, but yeah, like at some point there's this arc and Spider-Man uncovers like all the stuff they were up to. Oh, right. I think they're Russian spies. Yeah. His parents turned out to be Russian spies or something. And it's a whole thing. And it's kind of difficult for him because he thought they were dead. And then, like, they turn up, or at least his dad does, I think. Or maybe his mom. I forget which one of them turns up. But yeah. And he finds all of these things out. And it's just this really difficult thing for him to go through because he thought his parents were great people, and then it's like, oh, not really. With the Andrew Garfield movies, it was like they turned out to be super secret, awesome scientists who developed gene technology so good that they had to destroy it, except Oscorp found out and then killed them and then started making their own crazy genetic experiments, and then just like a whole thing. And they totally got the lizard wrong as well. So yeah, they kind of got his character wrong because in like the comics, he turns into a lizard permanently, but he's still super smart and has all of his personality. Whereas in the movie, when he turns into the lizard, he becomes a monster that just completely mindlessly tears through people, which is just the heck are you doing, guys?
I don't know about that, but you know, there is one thing that Spider-Man Homecoming, as far as I'm concerned, makes an improvement, because you know, a lot of times we hold the materials of the comics that we grow up with as sacred, that you know, you're not allowed to take liberties with the material. But the one thing that always bothered me, which they, as far as I'm concerned, made a correction, is how in the hell does a high school student that's like 15 years old have an aunt that's like 80 years old? That's more than twice like his mother's, what it would be his mother's age. Like, that doesn't make any sense why in the comics even that Aunt May is always this elderly woman who looks like she's on the brink of death.
Yeah.
Like, no, if he's 15, his mom is probably inner maybe 40.
Well,
so
I mean,
the aunt shouldn't be 80 years old.
That's kind of where the parent thing came in the arc, because they only settled down to have a kid after like the height of their spy career. So they ended up being in their like 40s or 50s.
Well, see,
when
they never explained that in the movies.
No, but that's in the comics.
I see. I had no idea.
So, I mean, that's
when did that happen in the comics though? That's not in the original like Spider-Man issue one.
Oh no, no,
like,
no,
this
no.
must have been much
no,
later.
No, like issue one, he's with Aunt May yeah, and all they of that don't stuff. Like they don't go into the parent thing until much later. Okay. Like it's
so
this
they,
one
they created this whole backstory.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean that's why in the original continuity Aunt May is old, because his parents had him when they were okay. older.
Is that still relevant in the current continuity, in the original continuity? Are they still with that?
I'm not sure if that's what happens in the ultimate continuity. I know the original continuity has that, but the ultimate universe I think has a different take. I think it probably is closer to what is in the Andrew Garfield one. I think in the ultimate continuity, his parents were scientists. I'm just not sure on the details. But it's interesting we talk about changes to continuity, because I think that's one of the really big things that Spider-Man did, what Spider-Man Homecoming did, because they basically took a hatchet to continuity in the best possible way. They were just like, oh, Aunt May's supposed to be an elderly lady. It's Marissa Tomei now, motherfuckers. Oh, MJ is supposed to be a redheaded white girl. Oh, it's Zendaya now. Oh, too bad. They just roll with it. They just make all these changes and they just work so well. And so many moments in the movie where they literally kind of throw it in your face that this is not the regular continuity you're used to anymore. Like,
and when was it?
The two Shockers, for example.
Right.
The guy that got disintegrated is the Shocker in the comics. And
oh, really? I don't know anything
yeah,
about that
so
character.
So Vulture just kills him.
Yeah.
And then, oh, you're the Shocker now.
How do you know he's the Shocker in the comics? Did they mention
the
his name?
Yeah, I don't they mentioned remember. The name. They okay. mentioned the name. So, yeah, like he's supposed to be the Shocker that's in the comics. But yeah, like,
honestly,
the Vulture just kills him.
That character doesn't really matter all that much.
No, of course not.
I mean, like, who cares who it really is?
Yeah,
the character is the Gauntlet, not. He's a common criminal.
Exactly. So, I mean,
not a super
a lot
genius.
Of these changes, it's like, this is kind of the fundamental thing about diversity in movies. If you can take a character and give that role to a different actor of a different ethnicity or group and have it really not be different at all, then, like, you've kind of succeeded in everything you're trying to accomplish, right? Like,
and when was the last time you ever had a when has a white character had an African American girl be interested in as a like a love interest? I've never seen that.
Yeah.
Certainly not in a Spider-Man movie.
No. Like, even that's huge.
And she wasn't even anyone. Like, she wasn't, as far as I know, she wasn't anyone in the comics. She was just another girl in school he was interested in.
Yeah.
So I think that was bold.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that, like, you know, change for the sake of change because you want to be progressive is, I don't know if that's great either, but
it is
nice that they're just breaking norms, saying we don't always have to have the same characters that you know in the comics that are the same white, because there's a lot of white people in Spider-Man too.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, come on, that's
really
not realistic.
There really are. And yeah, like Homecoming, it felt real. It felt like this is an actual technology high school for gifted kids. Like, there was a diversity there that made sense.
And I really felt that Peter Parker as a character was really struggling to balance that life of there's this new thing that he's dealing with, having these incredible powers. He doesn't know what to do with them.
Yeah.
He doesn't know really what a superhero does. I mean, he does know superficially, but he doesn't understand the job. And so he's trying to have this relationship. And you see that one critical moment in the movie where he's like, and I guess it's hard for me to spoil it, but he has to make this decision. Do I go to this party and spend time with this person, or do I try to stop a criminal? And you can see that he's really struggling with this. Like, he really wants to go after, what's her name? I've already forgotten her
Elizabeth.
Name. Elizabeth. And he makes a decision, but it's not the one that he really wants. He just feels like it's something he needs to do because he has these powers.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a great example of how this movie showed and didn't tell. Like all the other films, they always drilled the whole fucking with great power comes great responsibility bullshit. And we got to see Uncle Ben die twice. This movie, it's just like the only time it even gets mentioned is a passing reference to with everything May went through. Ben's name is not even mentioned.
I think modern storytelling. It's just better.
Yeah.
Like we all know, okay, we know that's what Uncle Ben tells in the comics that was written in the 30s. Like it's 2017. We don't need to hammer that home like you're saying.
No, exactly. Like just show it. Just show, like show the values that were instilled in Peter through his actions. And that's exactly what this film does. We see that struggle within him. He wants to do what he wants to do, but he can't because he knows what he should do. And you see that internal conflict throughout the film. And I mean, it's another big thing in this film was legacy. So like, we're now at a point in the Marvel Cinematic Universe where we're transitioning from the original group of heroes to a new group of heroes who are going to take up the mantle. And so one of the elements that was really nice to see was Tony Stark in the film, because, and this is something that I don't think DC has earned. This is something Marvel has only earned by making, like, what is this? The 23rd Marvel movie, 24th Marvel movie, something crazy like that. Like, they have earned this because they have laid that foundation, because we have seen these characters for years. Like, we know Tony Stark's deal because we've seen him in X number of movies that have told his story all the way up until now. We know that history. And then we see through Peter's eyes, like, he idolizes Tony Stark and he wants to be him. And it just crushes him and disappoints him how little Tony cares about him. Like, you see it in those moments where he's trying to contact Tony Stark, trying to get in with the Avengers.
And it seems like a very teenager thing to do.
Yeah.
His behavior, his texting behavior and patterns, sending a million messages to Jon Favreau's character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
And that moment in the limo, I'm not reaching for a hug. I was just going to open the door for you.
Yeah. I mean, Robert Downey Jr. just does those moments so well.
And like that moment where I don't remember the exact words. It was something like, I don't want you to be me. I want you to be better.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that scene wouldn't have had the impact it did if it weren't for all of the movies we've seen him in, because we know where he's been. We know what he's gone through. We know the issues he's struggled with. And so when he stands there and says that to Peter, we understand everything behind that statement. And that only works because of all the films that have preceded it.
I guess, but they, you know, the one thing that I guess it's too late now, but they never really covered Tony Stark's alcoholism. Like sometimes you'll see him with a drink in his hand, but they never really show him like at rock bottom.
Well, yeah. I mean, they got close in Iron Man 3, but they were focusing more on the Extremis storyline.
I did not like that movie.
Yeah, it wasn't great. There is an arc where Tony Stark deals with his alcoholism. It's called Demon in a Bottle. It's probably one of the best Iron Man arcs ever done. They had elements of it in Iron Man 3, but they didn't really go there. I don't know if they will.
There might be an well, there's always an opportunity. Depends whether or not they want to do another one, but you know, I only really liked the first Iron Man movie. There have been three. I did not like the second one, and I didn't think the third one was a good one. So I hope they do another one, and I think there's still time. Maybe even more so now, just because, like you're saying, there have been all these movies that the character has been in, and he's been through a lot, and he has the stress of dealing with this team, dealing with consequences of events that have happened, loss of life, the aftermath, you know, the pros and cons of being quote unquote a hero. And maybe that can sort of drive him. They can incorporate that. And maybe that propels him to drink or something. So maybe the next Iron Man movie could begin with him at the bottom of a bottle or something.
Maybe. I mean, if they do another one, it was kind of weird in Homecoming because Gwyneth Paltrow just randomly shows up again as Pepper Potts. It's like, oh, are they back together now? Like, I mean,
their Facebook status is complicated.
Yeah, I mean, in reality, it's, oh shit, Goop isn't doing so well. I guess I'd better be in another one of these things to make some money. But yeah, like that relationship has always kind of been weird. And of course, Gwyneth Paltrow's unavailability has made it difficult to kind of carry on that storyline properly.
What do you mean? I'm sorry, I don't... What do you mean by unavailability? Just like she's busy? She doesn't have time to film
like
it? Or?
She's...
No, she's got her businesses and side projects.
Yeah,
but.
Like since Iron Man 3, she hasn't really been around at all. Like...
I don't follow her career, so she just hasn't been acting all that much?
I don't know if that's true. I think she's been in stuff, but she's kind of refused to be in more Marvel films up until now. And... You really feel that in Civil War because
why? Because
she's supposed to be there and then she's not, and it's this whole thing. But it would have been a much more powerful moment if we got to see them have that struggle with their relationship where Tony is haunted and she's just like, I can't deal with this. Yeah. You need to sort this out.
Like, I feel like we're writing the script as we go along for the next Iron Man. Let me get a pen. I'm going to start writing.
Yeah, like that could have been in Civil War if she'd been available or wanted to do it. They could have had that scene and it would have just made it so much more impactful than, oh, she's not here for reasons.
Did Gwen find a link between Marvel movies and cancer?
I don't know. But I bet you can buy some sort of knickknack on Goop that
we
clears
buy
that
some,
right up.
Some vegan, I don't know, some vegan aerosol spray. Well, it would be aerosol.
Yeah, no aerosols.
Spray this mist on your body and get rid of the cancer.
Yeah.
All right, so let's wrap on Spider-Man, I think.
Yeah,
so I think we both agree we're gushing over the movie.
Yeah,
it's very good. If you haven't seen it and you're listening to this now, as of... July 12th, go and see it.
Yes.
And speaking of good movies, too, I finally got around to seeing Wonder Woman, which is, and I don't think anyone can argue, the first and best DC film ever.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, they nailed this movie. It was so fun, entertaining, well-written, great story, great characters. Gal Gadot was like, enchanting. Chris Pine was hilarious.
Yeah.
And I can't think of anything that I didn't like in that movie. Mm. Robin Wright was great, even though she didn't have a big part.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just amazing.
All I can say is Patty Jenkins for DC Cinematic Universe creative director. Ditch
Zack Snyder. He did get a credit on
Ditch
there as producer.
Him.
I think executive producer or some kind of producer role.
Well, he's like running the whole thing, but it's like, no. He doesn't get it. Get rid of him. Put Patty Jenkins in because she gets it. She understands intrinsically what makes DC what it is, what makes DC good. And it's not the heroes per se. It's not the stories per se. It's this ideal of what a superhero can be and what a superhero can mean to people. Like, we saw it in when Wonder Woman saved that French town. Like, the joy.
Oh, my God, that scene.
Well, later on, yeah.
I'm a little embarrassed to say this, but I actually started to get choked up at that scene. And I think it's because I just love strong women. I've been surrounded by strong women all my life. And to finally see a movie where we get to see this character who is a role model for young girls. And in the movie theater, there were young girls like less than 10 years old. Yeah. Like cheering Wonder Woman on, and I can only imagine them going home and dressing up like Wonder Woman, and like that's amazing to me, and I just got really emotional watching it.
Yeah, I mean, there should be a ton of movies like this, and it's sad that there aren't. But yeah, like the thing it just gets so right is that DC heroes, they inspire hope. They stand tall in the face of overwhelming odds, and
except for Batman,
brooding. Yeah,
that's just the character, though.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Most of the DC heroes are like, yes, I have the power. I will stop these bad guys and save you. And
that could be, just as an aside, that could be, that would be a whole episode by itself, but. I would love to do an episode where we make the argument, maybe someone argues both sides, about how realistic it would be for somebody to hold that kind of pain and that kind of anger for that long. Can you really hold on to that deep-seated rage for that long? You know, to rage this one man war. I'll just leave it at that. Maybe we can do an episode later on about that.
Yeah. It'd be interesting. But yeah, like there's a panel of Wonder Woman that I saw, and it was this little girl running up to Wonder Woman and saying, "Can I get your autograph?" And she was dressed in like the Wonder Woman outfit. And Wonder Woman just smiles and goes, maybe one day I will get your autograph. And that's what it's all about. And that's what this movie gets so right. That DC heroes are these beacons of hope that keep inspiring people and pushing them to be better. And I mean, Marvel has their own thing with the fun and lightheartedness and humor, but DC really pushes home that hope that heroes can bring to people.
And especially in the light of the current political climate, it's such a refreshing thing.
Yes.
Where you some days wake up with just this sense of dread that, like, what is going on? You know, what is going on in the U.S.? Like, just...
Yeah.
It is nice to have that sort of break from reality, which we need. And I'm sure they will make more of these movies, but...
Oh, yes. They are already working on a sequel.
Right.
That will probably take place in the U.S.
Do we know if Patty Jenkins is going to be directing it again?
Oh, yes. She will be. She just really needs to run DC because...
Yeah.
Like, I just know that Justice League is going to come out and we're going to compare it to Wonder Woman and it's just going to be like... This is not even close.
Well, they're going to be very different movies. I'm already calling it right now, and I think it's just the nature of the movie, of getting that big group of characters together. I think it's just going to be one big explosion.
Yeah.
It's just, the movie. It's like, it's not going to have any substance to it.
No, and the problem is, like I said earlier, DC hasn't earned it. They haven't done enough films to bring these people together. Like, we don't know half of them. We know Batman, sort of. We know Superman, sort of. We know Wonder Woman. Like, I would say at this point, Wonder Woman is the most popular character and the character we understand the most and identify with the most. And then a bunch of the other characters are literally being introduced in this film. Aquaman, Cyborg, Flash. That's half the team that we haven't even seen, but they're just suddenly going to be in this film with no introduction, nothing behind them. They just show up and we're supposed to root for them or believe in them or get worried if they're in trouble. Like, we're just meeting them for the first time. There's no investment there. Not like in the Avengers when we'd already seen all of these characters in multiple movies. We had seen their journeys leading up to this moment. And like, this is something that Marvel just gets so right. Like, you can't rush these things. You can't just shoehorn a ton of characters into a film and go, here you go, here's your superhero film. Because if you've just introduced us to 20 different characters, are we really going to care about any of them?
Yeah, well, I mean, knowing Zack Snyder, the movie will be 5 hours long, so he'll make up for it in length.
Yeah, that'll be the director's cut, though. Yeah,
well, the ultimate director's cut.
In the theatrical version, nothing will make sense, and yeah, it'll include 5 minutes of,
well, that's my rule,
of Superman just screaming Martha.
That's been my rule with Zack Snyder movies lately, is to just don't go see them in the theater, because the director's cut is going to make more sense.
Yeah.
I mean, I never saw the theatrical release of Batman v Superman.
No, I didn't either.
And I can't even imagine that movie having, and I'm not even joking, 30 minutes less footage.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
How?
Like, the director's cut is cringy enough, but then to not have scenes that literally explain what's happening, like, the whole thing with Doomsday, there's right, a scene in the director's cut that's not in the theatrical release, and it explains exactly mm-hmm, what is happening with Doomsday.
Sure.
So, like, in the theatrical cut, he probably just shows up, and you're like, what the hell's going on? Like, there's no scene to set that, yeah, up.
Let's dovetail back to Wonder Woman just to wrap, and I want to ask you, is there one single moment you can think of that really stands out for you in that movie?
No Man's Land.
That's mine too.
Yeah.
Without question. That was such a powerful scene.
Oh yeah.
And executed so
and
well.
I'll tell you what I really enjoyed, the fact that they didn't go for the cheap laugh. Cause before she climbs up, they go, "It's no man's land, Diana. No man can cross it." And I was totally expecting them to have her say, "I am no man," or "I am a woman." And they didn't. She says, "Then I will be the first." Classy as fuck. I will tell you one thing that's kind of wrong with the film. This is going to ruin it a bit for you. At the end, when she kills the general with the sword, and she's surprised that everything is still happening, and he's like, "Maybe people are just bad, Diana." And she stops there and thinks about it. And it's like, whoa, we're having this really deep character moment where she's realizing that maybe it's just not that simple. And then right at that very moment, Ares fucking shows up right fucking behind her. And then it's like, oh, I guess she was right the whole time. There's Ares. Oh, okay.
I'm not sure I'm hearing a problem though with that scene. So
well, like,
it just felt...
They could have had this really poignant thing where it's not necessarily
like
all
Ares. I was expecting Ares to show up for real.
Of course he was going to show up, but they could have done it so differently. Like, they even have pieces of it in his whole argument to Diana about how he's not really the bad guy. Oh, I was just whispering things. They didn't have to do it. Like, they had pieces of what could have been a more interesting take on it. But instead it was like, no, he's lying. He just legit made them go crazy and want to kill each other. Because the minute she kills him, everyone's like, oh, everything's fine now, bro hug. Like, like that was the one part that I felt they could have just done differently or done better, because it just felt really cheap and cheesy compared to the rest of the film.
Yeah, I do. Now that you say that, I'm pretty sure I was thinking that too when I saw it. But to me, I don't know, the way I can the only way I guess I can sort of rationalize it is that the underlying message that maybe humans are just bad, is true, but maybe in that specific case with that specific war, maybe he just pushed them over the edge a little bit. I don't know.
Maybe, but then show
but
that.
It, but like, it was weird because everyone kind of just like stopped. Yeah, loading like, the bombs.
They didn't really show that at all. It was just like, oh yeah, he was responsible for everything. Everything's fine now. Woo.
Yeah, I'd like to know what they were thinking when they came up with that idea, because for me, I think what would have been better was that people just kept doing what they're doing, because that would have shown that humans are just, they have that dark side.
Yeah. Yeah, like the way I would have done it, I hate to be that guy and just be like, oh, I'll fix this movie. I know what I'm doing. But it's like, I think what would have worked better would have been something like, there's this long pause. She sees all of the things happening. Everything's going wrong. They're killing each other still. And she just kind of walks away. And then instead of Ares appearing behind her like that, he's just kind of there observing the handiwork, and she spots him and she walks over to him. Cause like to her, she knows that guy is the British, like politician guy. And she's like, what the hell are you doing here? And he's like, haven't you figured it out, Diana? And she's like, you're like, they still do that exchange where she's like, you're, and he's like, yes, I am. But
the guy could have been Alfred with that mustache.
I'll get to that in a minute. And then they're just kind of standing there watching them all kill each other. And he's like, it's amazing what you can do with a few words. I just gave them the plans and they did all this. I had nothing to do with it beyond that, like kind of thing.
Yeah. So doesn't that make you believe that it really was just up to their own free will?
Well, see, the reason that we know he's lying is because then they accompany his speech with that whole sequence where he's like hovering over them, whispering secrets into their ears. And they're just like, oh yes, I will do this evil thing now. Like,
well, I guess again, this is up to interpretation. You could take that literally or not. To me, I guess the way I looked at that it was more of a sort of metaphor for the sort of devil on your shoulder kind of a thing.
Yeah.
That it wasn't literally him being there doing that. That was more speaking to, that's humanity's dark side. Like, that's a part of us. It's innate.
Yeah. But I mean, I would have shown that more explicitly. Like, instead of giving this vague thing where it's like, oh yeah, I guess it was him the whole time then. Like, I would have just... Mm-hmm. I would have made it more open-ended where we don't see that sequence where he's like whispering in people's ears. I would have just had him monologue and be like, you see what happens? I just gave them the tools and they used them.
And if it is the case that is what they were going for, like what I just said with it not being like a literal thing, then that to me is more of a, that's maybe more of an execution issue. Yeah. On their part.
Yeah, I think so. Like, I think they were trying to go for something a bit more subtle where it's like, he's not literally controlling them. But then they had the thing where she kills him and then they're all like, yeah, let's hug it out. Like, I wouldn't have done that exactly. Like, I think she kills him and then maybe they pause for a minute. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's like kind of a bit of calm, and then maybe some people are still fighting and some other people get killed and some things are happening off in the distance. But then like maybe then there's this moment where a few of them, not necessarily all of them, but a few of them are just like, what are we doing? and then kind of recapture that innate humanity instead of just instantly being washed over with this feeling of peace. It's like kind of a more gradual thing. So
no,
I
hear you. I think that's a valid critique.
Like,
for sure.
It really just came down to execution. I think they just handled it really poorly, and they could have just been a bit more deft with it and just make it this more subtle transition that's like, he wasn't controlling them, but he was exerting a subtle influence over them. Like, he was pushing them and making it more likely that they would be violent to each other. Like, it, and I think that's normally the way he's portrayed in the comics. It's never he mind controls people. It's he just brings out that desire for violence in people. So, I mean, yeah, like, they could have just handled it a bit better than they did. And then the mustache, for some reason, when he's talking about how he was cast down by Zeus, he still had the mustache in the scene that's supposed to be ancient Greece.
That was
which
weird.
Is like, so what? He invented that style and just waited
a thousand
years for it to be fashionable in Victorian England? Like, what? He just hid in a cave until Victorian people were walking around with mustaches, and he was just like, right. Aha!
Yeah,
at last, it has arrived.
That was a bit weird.
Like,
definitely was a bit
like
weird.
That was just really, really bizarre. Like, I would have given him a beard or just had him clean shaven for that scene, because it just made no sense. Like, why would he have a Victorian mustache in ancient Greece?
Why would he even look human, though?
Well, I mean, no, the gods looked human, which is fine.
Okay,
like, that's fine. But yeah, like, he had the big bushy Victorian mustache in a scene that's supposed to be ancient Greece. It just totally suspended disbelief for me.
I agree. A beard would have been better, actually. Like,
But I mean, that's just me nitpicking and being like,
sure.
Worst movie ever. Like, yeah, it was still weird though. But overall, it was a very good film.
Agreed. You've been listening to the Impromptu One Hologram Radio. I'm Alex Knight, joined by Michael Norton, as always. If you'd like to show your support for this podcast and the work that we do here, the single best way to do that is to go to patreon.com/hologramradio and donate today. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes to ensure you get every new episode each and every week. And do leave us a review if you have a moment that makes us feel good, as well as helps other people find the podcast. We're also available in Google Play Music, TuneIn, and Stitcher as well if you'd like to stream it there, and wherever else you can find podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at The Impromptu. Michael Norton is at Zen Impulse. I'm at Zero Distraction. And if you'd like to send us feedback the old-fashioned way, you can email us at theimpromptu@hologramradio.org, and that will go to both myself and Michael.
And on that note, thanks for listening, everyone. See you next time.